Hey folks, welcome to the August 22nd version of the Table Podcast. This is a re-recording for podcast of the Talkie Bit from that date due to a technical problem. This is a fresh version, but the content will be essentially the same, if a little less extemporaneous. We're continuing in our series about doubt and belief, and I think we're at part 8 today. And I'm talking about how to doubt better. And that's not a stage thing. This series, we've been working with stages of doubt and re-examination of belief. This particular set of ideas crosses those boundaries. Better at some stages than at others, to be sure. But we can doubt anytime, no matter where we're at in our journey. And I think most of what we're going to examine today about how to doubt better moves from stage to stage reasonably well. Might not work that great in stage one, where doubt is just sort of forbidden. But even there, it can inform our experience. And before we get going, we're going to stop and breathe together. And today, I would encourage us to hold space for being deeply, consciously grateful to be here on this land, wherever this land is for you. I'm assuming the North American continent when I say that, which I realize might not cover everybody that catches this, but on this land, this continent, where we, if we are of European ancestry or settler colonial ancestry, where we were welcomed by the First Peoples and First Nations of this area, and where regardless of where we're from in terms of ethnicity or culture, where we are all together sustained by the earth. If you are joining us just for the podcast and not online in other ways, then I'll just shorten the silence in the podcast. So if you don't want to stop and breathe, you can just carry on. But if you do, just hit the pause button and we'll breathe together. Okay, here we go. This earth, this right here, what I see out the window of the space where I record these, I look out at some prairie grass, grasses, tall wild grasses bordered by a row of trees, beyond which there's a creek, really quite a beautiful view out this window. That view, this actual patch of dirt that I look out at every time we gather online and every time I acknowledge the beauty of being welcomed here by the first indigenous peoples of this part of the earth. That actual patch of dirt is not my dirt. It's the dirt. It's not my earth. It's the earth. It's not my home. It's our home, by which I mean our shared home as human beings. We might not be used to thinking this way, and it can be really challenging to try, but when it comes to how we think about the earth and the world around us, consider this. We've just been through a very hot July here in this part of Canada, and now this last week we got a bunch of rain, which so overdue, practically speaking, and so welcome. The earth just soaked it up. It was just the right kind of rain, too. It just went right down into the earth, which is fantastic. The weather, when it comes to how we think about the earth and my place versus the place and so on, the weather doesn't care one bit who pays the taxes on this arbitrarily defined piece of earth that I might refer to as our yard or our home. The weather doesn't care that on the date where we recorded this, we had planned to gather on that piece of property together, to be together outside in person for the first time, with one or two outdoor exceptions, for the first time in over a year and a half. The sun shines, the rain falls, as Jesus put it, on the just and the unjust, which of course is just a sort of a rhetorical device, a way of saying rains on everyone without discrimination. And at least as Jesus talked about it, God doesn't mess with that. The weather is not a punishment and reward system in the hands of a fickle or volatile version of the divine. That perspective, that good, bad, and ordinary things happen to everyone, that's a hard one to hold, especially when we're under duress. It's a relatively relatively easy one to hold when things are going great. Oh, everybody has some problems. Rolls off our tongue a little easier when we're not on the problem side, you know? We might try to hold that perspective when we're suffering, but when we're feeling the weight of the world and of life, we can come to the limits of our ability to hold that perspective pretty readily. One of the reasons might be that we really don't like to face the possibility that life is sometimes random, that not everything happens for a reason, or that as much as it might feel good in the short term to do so, blaming someone else for whatever is going wrong is rarely helpful, and it's often just illogical as well. To think that way might mean to entertain those ideas, is what I'm getting at, might mean we have to challenge some deeply ingrained, perhaps even consciously cherished perspectives, things that are really dear to us. In lots of ways, perspectives, how we hold them, how they impact us, are at the heart of this exploration. You've heard me say before that I believe we're perspectival knowers. We see the world from a particular vantage point. Most of us would find that reasonable most days. Maybe we've had direct experiences that have caused us to realize the way we were seeing some situation was incomplete, or it was skewed by our vantage point or our previous experiences or our emotions in that moment. One of my mentors, when I was learning how to paddle in whitewater, liked to tell the story of how he met his wife. He was teaching a course on whitewater canoeing, and she ended up being the bow paddler in his canoe for a section of the day. And during the course of a run down a particularly noisy rapid, he had to communicate paddling instructions to her at several points. And because of the noise level of this rapid, which was also sort of in a bit of a canyon space, he had to shout. And they successfully navigated the rapids. And once they were in calm water again, she turned around and he could see that she was in tears. And not kind of these, you know, my eyes are a little moist, I'm tearing up kind of tears, but these big, heart-rending sobs kind of tears. And Ross, being a caring person, was both concerned and confused, because from his perspective, things had gone rather well. He had shouted directions, as was his role both as an instructor and as the stern paddler, who is traditionally sort of the captain of the ship. And his bow paddler and student had done an admirable job of her role. Everyone had arrived safely at the bottom with expanded skills and experience. And so, cha-ching, right? Well, not this time. All his partner could think of was that she was being yelled at. And in her lived experience, that level of yelling meant someone must be either in mortal danger or angry to the point of violence. And either way, she was emotionally devastated. It took some sorting out, but you know, in this case, it ended in true love, which is nice, right? Because it doesn't always turn out like that. One way to understand what happened in that story is to think about what causes us to feel the emotions we do in a given circumstance. It's interesting to think about, because until we do, we might think that our emotions can be trusted. And in particular, we might think they can be trusted to tell us the truth about what we are experiencing. And if that's the case, then we can also reliably let them guide the actions we choose to take. As it turns out, that's not the way it works. Our emotions can be trusted, just not for that. And here's why. What we feel, our emotions, are not caused by external events. And just that idea alone is enough to kind of make some of us go, whoa, 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 whoa. What do you mean they're not caused by external events? Of course they're caused by external events. Just take it down a layer. Our emotions are not caused by external events. They're caused by our beliefs about those events. To put it another way, what we feel is directly connected to how we cognitively process and evaluate what's happening to us, how we evaluate the events. It's what we believe about what we're experiencing that triggers our emotions, not the event itself. Our emotions can be trusted to illustrate not what is happening, but what we believe about what is happening. And then to make it even more interesting and complex, much of what we think and believe is not conscious. unless we stop to evaluate and reconsider, there's a lot of that process that just happens. And as with breathing, physical breathing, if we stop and think about it like we did just a few moments ago, we can alter it. But most of the time, it just happens. And it can even change a great deal without our being aware of the changes. As happens if we're startled, you know, big kind of gasp in, or if we have to sprint because the little walking person on the crosswalk changed to the talk to the hand person, or just the hand actually sooner than we expected. The other thing that adds complexity to this is that our beliefs and subsequently our evaluation of the event we're experiencing are often not rational and irrational, or what a therapist might formally call cognitively distorted evaluations, might cause emotional or behavioral consequences that often in turn lead to increased distress or conflict. That's kind of a pile on, right? Might sound like mostly bad news. But inside of all of that, here's the good news. We can change what we believe. We are not our beliefs. We have our beliefs. We are not our emotions. We experience our emotions. We are not our thoughts. Those are also things we have. In many ways, the table exists because of this very idea. As with breathing, we can just kind of let it happen, or we can work with it as part of a conscious process, which then in turn changes the way it functions, even when we're not deliberately thinking about it. So just like we can train ourselves cardiovascularly in ways that change our breathing. So if we decide we're going to strengthen our heart and our lungs and our oxygen uptake ability, we start walking briskly for, you know, long enough each day, or we start running or riding our bike or swimming or something that gets our heart going and our lungs going, and those things get stronger. There may be things about our unconscious breathing that change as well. Our heart rate, our resting heart rate might go down. Our ability to bring oxygen into our bodies with each breath might go up. And we might not be conscious that those things have changed, but we change them by conscious choice. We change them by training, right? So the conscious inputs can equal changes to the unconscious process. There's a whole group of therapies that have developed around this this idea that we can change what we believe, which I wanted to mention, but I'm not going to get into them. If you're interested, you could look up things like cognitive behavioral therapy or the ABC, or sometimes called the ABCDE method for dealing with cognitive distortions and irrational beliefs. There's a lot you can learn just on your own because we live in the Googleverse, but I would also say that there can be a lot of benefit in working with someone who's skilled in using these tools if you feel like you really want to dive in. In our context at the table, which is exploring what we believe, I titled this talky bit How to Doubt Better, and I promised in the blurb I wrote about it earlier in the week to connect it to the series we're in, so I think maybe it's time to see if I can deliver on that promise. I'm going to keep this pretty simple in the interest of time, but maybe we can explore it more another time, and I'm always down to chat about it in person or by email with anybody that wants to have a further conversation about it. Here's the short version, though. Our beliefs, the way we think about what is happening to us and around us, is what trigger our emotions. So our beliefs trigger our emotions. And our emotions, because they happen in our bodies, emotions are body things. Emotions, because they happen in our bodies, tend to drive our actions, which is, of course, what we do with our bodies. So when we start to question what we believe, that whole sequence can get messed with. Lots of us have had the experience of, you know, I don't know what I believe. Well, take a moment in your imagination to drop the reality of that kind of an experience into the model we've just been considering. Let's imagine that something challenging happens to me. I don't know what I believe about why it's happening or what that means. Well, what might happen to my emotions? They might go into a tailspin, right? Or they might just go into lockdown. I might not be feeling much of anything. I might feel just shut down. I might feel out of control. I might feel depressed. I might feel like my emotions are all over the map. And because actions come out of emotions, my actions might now be all over the map as well. I use this language advisedly, but this can really sometimes add up to me feeling like I'm going a little bit crazy, like I don't know myself anymore, and I'm unpredictable or unstable, or like I just don't or even can't care about much of anything. Not a nice space to live in at all. Some of you might remember that last week I closed with two stories, a Jesus story and one from an indigenous author. The Jesus story I just sort of glanced at, and I want to take a moment to dig into it a little bit more. The story itself, the setting for this, the moment I want to explore, is the part in the Jesus narratives where there's a whole bunch of people coming to arrest Jesus, and that group is led by Jesus, you know, air quotes, friend Judas, who famously betrays him with a kiss. And even if he didn't grow up around the Christian stories at all, the idea of a Judas kiss as the betraying act of a friend still has some cultural traction. This was a moment that stirs the imagination to this day. And Jesus is accompanied in this moment, in this experience, by some of his followers, including Peter. All right, little pause button here. I know that there are people in this community, both sort of local and dispersed, for whom telling a story from the Bible is all the reason you need to hit the stop button. It's not a book that is a friend. In many cases, because it's been used in ways that have created personal trauma and disruption, that have poisoned the well, so to speak, that have exacerbated feelings of unworthiness and shame and guilt and all those kind of things. I get that. I really do. And I just want to say, as I've said many times before, and I'm sure I'll say many times again, pick up what's for you. Don't pick up what isn't for you. If this is a bailout point, don't feel, I'm going to tell you how to feel. From my perspective, going out the side door at this point is completely understandable and valid and not a reason to feel guilty or ashamed or like you let yourself down or let somebody else down or like your soul is in jeopardy. It's a response. It's the kind of thing we're talking about, but it's a response from deep inside of you to experiences you've had that your body remembers certain ways, among other things. But if we're going to keep going, one of the things that's worth remembering is that this is a story that is most often used in religious settings to convey a particular thematic religious or theological message, and as a result, many of us might not have considered the very human behaviors it contains. All of the stories in this library that we might just call the Bible have this about them. There's characters in them, and the characters behave things, which means that the characters have emotions, because actions come from emotions. And because they have emotions and they're experiencing events, that means they have certain beliefs about what those events mean. And if we look at the story through that lens, there's often tremendous lessons in there for us that don't have to also carry the baggage of particular dogmas. Anyway, that's kind of the lens we're using. So this is where we come to the part of the story about how what we believe about what is happening is what informs our actions and our emotions. So here's what's going on in the story. Crowds coming to arrest Jesus. Jesus, on the other side of the equation, is with some of his followers, with whom he's been spending some intense time in the last few moments of the story. Peter, one of the followers of Jesus, who's in that crowd, Peter's a zealot. Not as in zealous, although that's certainly true about him as far as we can tell, but as a part of a group of people who were identified by that name. That was a name of a group, the Zealots. And in the first century, the Zealots were a Jewish group that advocated violence against the Romans and their Jewish collaborators. The Zealots were Jewish, and from their vantage point, there were certainly other people of their ethnic group that had sold out to the Romans, and they had nothing to do with them. In today's parlance, we might say they were activists. Depending on your perspective, we might say they were radicals or insurgents. When I shared this talky bit on our Facebook live stream the other day, somebody in the comments box typed in, you know, from today's perspective, Peter would be a terrorist. And if you were a Roman, I think that would certainly be fair, you know. The zealots were maybe, I don't know, this is a reach maybe, but maybe they were a little bit like Greenpeace, but without the green or the peace, you know. Oh, and they were armed. So, okay, nothing like Greenpeace. They were activists is the point I was trying to make. And these are a group of people who got the supplies, you know, that they needed by raiding Roman storehouses. So activist, you know, writ large. For the Jewish people in general, Messiah stories were central to their worldview. And I feel confident saying that as a non-Jewish person because it's sort of all over the record. It's all over the First Testament record on which the Judeo-Christian tradition stands, a tradition I've grown up in and around. Those Messiah stories are central. But not everyone understood that broad Messiah framework in the same way. There were lots of different ideas about how that mythology would play out in history. For the Zealots, their lens on that was that the Messiah would be a leader who would guide them into battle against the foreign forces that were occupying Palestine. The Zealots looked forward to a Messiah whom God would send to expel the Romans from Palestine and restore the kingdom of God, what we might today generally think of as the Middle East, to the chosen people, the people whom God had given it to in the first place. So that was their perspective. They were looking for a military leader who would galvanize the people, swords up, blood running in the streets, slaughter the Romans, take over the seat of government, be their own nation, independent, undivided again. Well, despite considerable evidence that Jesus was not that Messiah, including some rather dramatic street theater performances illustrating that exact point, some of which Peter had been a part of, Peter believed Jesus was that Messiah. So when these folks come to arrest Jesus, Peter experienced that as a threat to everything he held hopeful in his belief about the future of his own future and the future of his people. And his emotions, because of that belief, his emotions activated his body, because that's what our emotions do, and he whipped out his sword to do what he would have understood to be the right thing, which was to beat back the threat to his Messiah with direct action, with violence. Whenever I read this story, and Peter kind of, not all the storytellers in the Gospels tell it the same way. They don't all include the violence. But when I think about the versions that do, I think about Peter kind of whipping out his sword, and I think, did he carry that thing all the time? Was this a concealed carry? How big a sword was this? Was Jesus like, yeah, this is one of my followers. He always carries that thing, no problem. Or was it just that night? Is it a rhetorical device? Like, I don't know. But anyway, that's how the story goes. Jesus, who clearly views the same circumstances, they're having the same experience at the same time, he clearly views the same circumstances differently because what he does is couldn't be more different than what Peter has done. What he does is that he heals the person Peter's just injured, and you can think of that what you will. We're not taking it on in the moment. And he tells Peter in no uncertain terms what most English translators write as something like, no more of that. Not what we're on about here. Same events, different understanding, different emotions, different actions. So if we were to continue viewing this story through that lens, we would shortly come to a part of the narrative where we would see Peter dissolved in bitter tears because he finds that his worldview won't even hold up to the casual fireside challenges of a stranger. It's interesting that in the narrative about the violence, about the sword, there are soldiers in that group, there are high-ranking religious officials in that group, powerful people in different ways, militarily powerful, socially powerful, religiously powerful. The person Peter takes a swipe at, according to the storytellers, is basically the assistant to the high priest. So like the secretary that got, you know, the PA that got dragged along on this little debacle. So he might not have been as dyed-in-the-wool a zealot as he thought himself to be. But in any case, that's what happens to him in the kind of the next chapter. Having our understanding of what is going on challenged as Peter's was in that moment, whether that's by redirection from someone we respect or by circumstances or by doubt, can rock our world. And again, with the good news, how we view what we are experiencing, how we view what we're feeling, how our actions arise from those linkages, these are things that we can access and we can learn about and we can change. Just the knowledge that there is a profound link between our thoughts, our feelings, and our behavior can be empowering. Just knowing that can help us better understand what is happening to us when our doubts feel like they're not staying in the rational part of our mind, but they're starting to mess with our emotions and with our subsequent behavior. And with that kind of knowledge in hand, I believe we can more bravely and with reduced distress and anxiety explore what we believe, knowing that the process might sometimes be disquieting and disturbing and disruptive, but that we can also consider our thoughts and our beliefs, and we can change them. And as we do that work, as we learn to be aware of how our beliefs are connected to our emotions, and we get in there and tinker with that, and our beliefs change, our emotions, our experience of events can change as well. And so we can experience a similar event, but have a different belief about it, and have a different, more productive emotional and action response to it. And take some work, some self-awareness for sure, but these are doable things. I'd sum it up this way. We can learn to doubt better, folks. And doing that work can help us be more at home with ourselves, more at home with our doubts, more at home with our changing beliefs, more at home with those around us that are dealing with those same kinds of things, more able to empathetically respond when someone's belief lens stirs up powerful disruptive emotions and produces perhaps aggressive or troubling actions as well. So it can help us on a bunch of fronts. And taken together, these are the kind of things that can be life-changing. They really can. Thanks for listening. I don't take it for granted that anyone would take the time to sit down, you know, put in the earbuds, push play, do whatever they do while they're listening, but just that people would take the time to consider these things together feels like an enormous gift to be a part of that, of a community that would do that, and I'm so grateful. I'm going to leave it right there, but all being well, we'll chat again soon. Take good care. Bye for now.